Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Christopher Freiman. He's Associate Professor of Philosophy at the College of William and Mary. His research interests include democratic theory, distributive justice, and immigration. He's the author of two books. The first one, Unequivocal Justice, and the most recent one, Why It's Okay to Ignore Politics. And I have it here with me, the printed version, and that's what we're going to talk about today. So, Dr. Freiman, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I love the promotion, showing the book cover right off the bat. It's perfect.
Yeah, great, great. By the way, I really love the book, so it has some arguments that I sort of have already thought a little bit about, but the way you presented them was more in depth, let's say, so it was really nice to read
Well, thank you.
it. So let's start with this. Where does the idea that people should be politically engaged and things like, for example, I know that people who are politically motivated usually moralize the fact that people decide not to vote, some people. And so, where do these ideas come from?
Well, so I think if we're asking, why lots of people seem to think that we, maybe lots of non-philosophers think that we have a duty to vote. My best guess is, I don't know. It starts young. So I have two kids, almost 9 and age 6, and they're already hearing a lot about the importance of voting at school, and this is something that seems to be really hammered home at an early age, that this is a civic duty. Everybody has to vote. I think in the book I talk a little bit about an old episode of Sesame Street where Big Bird is talking about the importance of voting. Like, this is Sesame Street is very concerned with voting. And so I think, yeah, there's just a lot of education that goes towards promoting a duty to vote, not just at the early age, but also as you go up through high school and college. It's just a very consistent message that you hear all the time, particularly during election season. Go out and vote. I was watching, I forget what, like football or something like that, or commercials where the football players are like, make a plan, go and vote. So it never stops. You never stop hearing the you must vote message.
Yeah, right. Do we know why people vote and why they decide to abstain from voting? Do we know the reasons that are usually behind those two kinds of decisions?
Yeah, there is interesting work on why people decide to abstain. So one reason that people often give is just they don't think that their vote is going to make a difference. And also sort of related to that is they think, look, neither party is really looking out for people like them, and so they become disillusioned. But also there are obstacles to voting, sort of institutional obstacles. And so I think those are parts of the explanation of why people decide not to vote. In terms of why people do decide to vote, I think this idea that it's an important civic duty certainly plays an important role. I mean, you're hearing this message constantly and you think, okay, this is important. And there's also what's called the expressive theory of voting, which says, well, if you're a partisan and you're on Team Democrat or Team Republican, you go to the polls and you vote, even knowing that it's not really going to make a difference to the outcome of the election, but you do it as a way of cheering on your team in the same way that you cheer on your favorite football team, even knowing that that's not going to make a difference, but that's just what a loyal fan does, is they cheer on their team. And this, I think, plays a large role in motivating people to go out to the polls.
By the way, you touched there on a point that I would like to explore a little bit more, and you also touch on in your book. Does voting or individual votes really make a difference, as some people say? Because there are people that say every vote counts. So, is that true?
So I think there are cases, depending on the election and depending on the state that you're voting in, where the odds of your vote making a difference to the outcome of the election are not so low that maybe you shouldn't vote. So it could be the case that you live in a state where you say, well, it's maybe a 1 in an 8 million chance, that my vote could actually make a difference to the outcome. I say, well, 1 in 8 million chance of affecting the outcome of this huge event, a national scale election, that might be worth doing. And so maybe somewhere between 6 and 10 states in any given election, it's not, the odds aren't so low. The trouble is, though, for the other sorts of states, for the other states, they could be really, the odds can be really terrible. We're talking 1 in a trillion type numbers. And so it's just not a good bet to cast a vote in those states. So at most, you could say maybe people who live in 6 to 8 to 10 states have a reason to vote, have a reason to expect that there's a non-trivial chance of making a difference. But the rest of us, it's just really hard to say that voting is worth doing, at least to affect the outcome.
But is it possible for us to learn enough to be able to rightly pick, to pick the right candidate in terms of their policies? Because in politics, people do deal with lots of different things. And for example, in the book, you say that in order for people to really pick the right candidate or party, they would have to learn about political science, social science, moral and political philosophy, and so on. So is that really feasible?
Right. So I think this is a really big issue. So even if you do live in one of the states where there's a non-trivial chance that you might make a difference, there's this further obstacle, which is how confident should you be that you're casting a vote for the right candidate? Because if you cast a vote for the wrong candidate and somehow you do, in fact, change the outcome of the election, then you would actually be doing something really bad because you would have voted for the wrong candidate who might do a lot of harm. And I think we tend to underestimate the difficulty of casting a good vote for the sorts of reasons that you mentioned. So you say, well, you just kind of have to know what the candidates stand for, which many people don't. But then even once you clear that hurdle, you say, well, okay, so maybe this candidate stands for this on education, and that candidate stands for that on education, and then immigration and criminal justice and all of these different issues. Say, okay, well, I need to evaluate these policies. I don't just need to know what they are. Are they efficient? What are the outcomes they're likely to bring about? So you need to know some social scientific knowledge. So you said political science, economics, and so forth. Wouldn't hurt to learn a little bit of philosophy. I'm a philosopher, so I'm biased. But it seems to me that that's also relevant for lots of these policy questions. Not just is it efficient, but questions like, is it fair? Does it respect people's rights and autonomy and so forth? This just takes a lot of work. And I think so most people haven't done that work. And you might think, okay, well, maybe I should set myself the task of actually doing this work. But now we're talking about spending a lot of time trying to cast a good vote, which in all likelihood is not going to make a difference. And so even in these cases where you think, well, I live in a swing state, and so there's actually a chance that I could change the outcome of the election. You probably shouldn't be confident that you're voting for the right person right now. And if you're not anticipating doing all of the work I just mentioned, then you probably should be skeptical that you're casting the right vote. And then you have to have a realistic assessment of the opportunity cost of acquiring that information. So you might say, ah, it's going to take me, I don't know, 40 hours to learn all this stuff. And that's 40 hours I could be doing something else to help the world. Then is it really worth it? Maybe, but it's not obvious to me that voting is going to be worth it as opposed to doing those other things that could help the world.
Yeah, we'll come to that point later on in the interview. But before that, even if people had all the factual knowledge, wouldn't it also be an issue that, we don't really derive directly oughts from ises? So, we can know how the world works, how society works, but when it comes to what we should do, we get into morality and ethics, and that's another completely different issue. And different people have different answers to the same problems.
That's right. So even if you had some kind of crystal ball that told you how every policy was actually going to work out, you could see into the future and say, okay, this is what's going to happen. Right, there's still these unresolved normative questions. that are just hard to be confident in. So just to take a simple example that of something that I work on, so you say immigration. You could have both sides acknowledge, although this typically doesn't happen, but you could imagine both sides acknowledging the facts, or they agree on the facts. And so they say, well, maybe immigration is tends to be good on the whole, both for receiving countries and for immigrants. But it does turn out that like particular low-wage domestic workers are in fact harmed by immigration. Let's say both sides agree to this. Well, that doesn't actually settle whether or not we should do this or not, because you could say, well, okay, do we owe something special to the global poor, because they're just in the worst off condition? Or do we owe something special to our compatriots? Like we have some sort of national partiality or something like that. So maybe we ought to favor poor compatriots, even though they're richer than the poorest immigrants. Or maybe you think, no, that doesn't really matter. What we should care about is alleviating the most severe forms of poverty. It doesn't really matter what nation you're in. Those are philosophical questions. Those are normative questions. And they're hard questions. I have opinions about these, but it takes a lot of thinking and studying, I think, to be confident about these sorts of issues.
And in terms of allocating time, should people follow the news on politics? I mean, is that something useful for them? Because I would guess that, I mean, it might be the case that people wouldn't make that big of a difference if they were to participate in politics, but politics still have a very big impact on their lives. So should they at least be informed?
Well, so it depends. So it might be helpful to be informed to understand the ways in which politics will impact your life and the life of other people. But I think it's usually not a great idea if you say, I'm going to spend a lot of time watching the news so that I can cast an informed vote, which is the way a lot of people talk, for the sorts of reasons we've been discussing already. So you can watch the news, debates, you can read the newspapers and so forth. For a 1 in what 60 million chance of actually making a difference, you say that's probably time that could be better spent elsewhere. And one thing I talk about in the book is the way that actually following political news makes us less happy. So many people will watch the nightly news only to be infuriated by it. So I talk about this story from my son, who I think was 5 at the time. Yeah, he had this great commentary. He said, so he'll visit my parents, and sometimes my father will be watching, I don't know, CNN or something like that, and getting really upset at politics. And my son, he says, why does grandpa watch the news if he doesn't like the news? I felt like this is exactly right. Like, why do this? So if you could do something incredibly valuable with that information that you acquire from the news, then that would be a different story. I would say, go ahead and acquire that information. The same way that, you go to medical school, that's difficult to acquire all that knowledge, but you could do something really good with that. But with political information, except in rare circumstances, you can't do a whole lot of value, do many things of value with that information. And so you're kind of just making yourself miserable for no reason. It would be like, you go to a dentist and you're like, just give me a recreational root canal. I don't need it. Just give me a root canal. It would be insane. But I think a lot of people have that same sort of experience with the news.
Yeah, right. I mean, and in term and regarding this last question, I have another question, I guess. So, does it have to do, your answer, does it have to do with how news are presented and the kinds of sources people have access to, like, for example, the normal news, the political debates, and so on? Or is it simply that it's not worth it to dispense time to inform yourself about all of these issues?
So I think it's both. So I think even if you were watching perfectly impartial, unbiased sources of news, it's just probably not worth doing simply because there's not a whole lot that you can do with that information that's going to make the world a better place. But I do think you mentioned something that's really important, which is most news watchers aren't actually seeking out the most unbiased and impartial sources of news. They're seeking out the sources of news that basically tell them what they want to hear, which is their party is good and the other party is bad. And so even in most cases where you're watching the news, it's not a great way to become informed and cast an impartial vote. It really is just something more like entertainment, where you're just being told what you want to hear.
Yeah, right. And by the way, isn't it the case that politically motivated people usually are the ones that contribute to issues like political polarization?
Right. So the people who sort of are most passionately partisan tend to be the ones who are the most politically active. And this is true on both sides of the aisle, which will exacerbate polarization. And this also kind of makes sense where if you go back to the sports analogy, where you say, you know, who's actually going to be the person who's going to pay for the ticket and drive to the stadium and watch the game in the freezing cold? The person who's going to pay that cost is the person who's a really passionate fan of the team. And you say something similar seems true in the case of politics. So who's actually going to be watching the news and debating politics on Facebook and then, you know, going out and casting a vote or trying to get other people to vote? It's the person who's the most passionate fan of their team. And so we kind of lose some of the potentially moderate political participants because the most active ones are the ones who are the most passionate and enthusiastically partisan.
Mm-hmm. And what about politicians? I mean, because we live in such big and complex societies, particularly nowadays, is it easy for politicians to make good decisions? Because, I mean, there's so much complexity that, I mean, sometimes they might be well-intentioned, but their policies don't end up with the results that they expect.
Yeah, I think this is a big problem. So even leaving aside worries about the incentives that politicians have to make good decisions, so if we set those aside, there is still this worry about, if you have a well-intentioned politician, how do they know the right things to do? And they face a predicament that's similar to voters, where we just have all of these issues. They're extremely complicated empirically and philosophically. And in my view, it's very hard to be confident that we know what the right thing to do is in a lot of these cases. So even if you do have a politician who says, all I want to do is serve the common good and make the world a better place, and their motives are totally pure. We have this fantasy politician who believes this. It's just really hard to make that call. And part of this is just due to the way how complex the world is. So I give the case in the book about, people think they understand zippers. And you're like, do you understand how a zipper works? And people go, yeah, no, I understand how a zipper works, no problem. And then they say, okay, well, explain to me, step by step, how a zipper works. And then they reflect on it and they think, huh, you know what, I actually don't know how a zipper works. That's weird. You think, okay, it actually is kind of hard to understand how a zipper works. And that's a pretty simple instrument, a zipper. And you use it all the time and you've seen it, it's like super easy. Say, okay, well, how about how does the world work? How do billions of people interact with each other? If you can't understand a zipper, it's going to be very, very hard to understand how the world works. And if we don't have a great understanding of how it works and how, a change here is going to have some sort of impact here, it's just going to be hard to reform it for the better, even with the best of intentions.
Mm-hmm. And can we trust the experts? I mean, would experts make better political decisions? Because I interview lots of scientists on the channel, and there are people that say that perhaps scientists should play more of a political role and be more politically engaged because the knowledge that they have would bring better results. But is that really the case?
So I do think it would be good if the public and politicians were more attentive to scientific experts, although I don't think that would completely solve the problem, simply because, as we've been talking about, there are still these really hard philosophical problems that aren't scientific questions. So we'll face trade-offs between different values. So scientists can say, maybe if we do this, then that'll happen, and if we do that, then this will happen. I think we should defer to them on those sorts of questions. But then that still leaves open the question of, okay, given that these are the trade-offs associated with our different options, what should we do? And you can say, well, I don't know, that's not a scientific question. Are there philosophical experts? Maybe. Like, I could buy the idea there are philosophical experts, but there's not exactly philosophical consensus on these questions in the way that there's scientific consensus on a lot of questions. So I do think we would be better off if we listened to the scientific experts on scientific matters more than we do. But I don't think that that solves the problem in its entirety.
Mm-hmm. So at a certain point in the book, you say, and now I'm going to quote you, people tend to shift their political opinions in ways that are congenial to their partisan identity. So could you explain that? I mean, would that mean that political ideology acts as some sort of post-hoc rationalization to even more so than a principled approach to politics?
Yeah, so the basic idea, this goes back maybe to the sports analogy, where people are loyal to their political team rather than particular moral or political principles. One interesting experiment on this is you give partisans different policies, one that you would characteristically associate with Republicans. It's something like a small welfare policy. And then one that you would characteristically associate with Democrats, a larger welfare policy. But you just attach a different partisan label to the policy. So you have the, let's just call it the Republican policy, but you say, oh, this Democratic senator is actually has endorsed this policy. And then you get Republicans who say, no, thanks, even though it's the sort of thing you would think they would endorse. You get Democrats saying, oh, yeah, that sounds good, even though it's the sort of thing that you wouldn't expect them to endorse. And so it turns out that people aren't ideologically motivated in the sense that they have this very firm commitment to certain moral and political principles. It's more like what their team does, they'll support, even if it looks like the sort of thing that they should not really be endorsing, given their professed ideology.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. In the book, you also talk about the social costs of political participation. I mean, you've already mentioned some of them. Could you tell us about these political costs in general?
Yeah, so I mean, one thing that's happening right now is with the sort of hyper-polarization we're experiencing, people are, no longer friends with people on the other side of the political aisle. They are less willing to hire them for jobs. They're less willing to award them scholarships. They don't want their children marrying members of the other political party. And this really does have a negative impact on society as a whole, on things like social trust. I mean, there's some really kind of alarming results too. So people are increasingly willing to dehumanize members of the other party, literally say they are less than fully human. They're less willing to attribute differences of opinion to just honest disagreement. And they're more likely to say, members of the other party are downright evil. They're not decent people. They're evil. And then there's, I think the most alarming one is a sizable percentage of partisans say it would be a good thing if a large number of members of the other party just died. That would be good for the country. And this to me is a really, really alarming result. And I think it's unhealthy. And we should try to do what we can to try to step back and help ameliorate things.
Mm-hmm. So at the beginning, when I asked you about voting, you mentioned that perhaps there are certain instances where an individual vote would count more than in others. Should people be engaged in local politics? I mean, because that's a different way of approaching things. It's more local, more specific, more concrete to the problems that they deal with every day. So what about local politics?
Yeah, I think there are definitely advantages to focusing on local politics. I think some of the information problems are somewhat less daunting. So for example, I don't know, there's a pothole down the street or something like that. And you could say, okay, I know that this is a problem, and let me try to lobby to get that fixed. That's not super complicated. The odds of you actually making an impact at the local level are much higher. So I think those are reasons that you might prefer to work on local politics rather than national scale ones. The downside, though, is that the payoff to having an impact at the local scale is a lot lower. So if you change the outcome of a presidential election, that's huge. That's monumental. If you get a pothole fixed, that's not nothing. But it's not like changing the outcome of a presidential election. And even then, I would say, and I think this is probably something we'll get to later, it's still probably the case that you will do more good for the world if you just forego local politics. You say, look, I'm not gonna worry about the pothole, and focus on raising funds for effective charities that help people who are in far greater need than the neighbor who's got a pothole on their street.
Yeah, we'll get into issues regarding effective altruism toward the end of the interview. So, what about when people say that if everyone thought that their political participation didn't matter and simply drop off of politics, that would be worse, some people argue. I mean, what is your response to that challenge?
Yeah, so a couple of responses. So I think there are different ways of interpreting that challenge. One is, and I've gotten people who will say something like this to me. They'll say, look, you shouldn't be, I'm not super upset if you don't vote, but don't go around broadcasting this idea because lots of people will stop voting and this will be very bad. And I say, okay. I like this objection because it's very flattering to me because it assumes that I have lots of influence on people's behavior. But sadly, I think this is just not true. I don't think there's any risk of my book bringing about large-scale behavioral change. And I know this is true. I mentioned this in the book. I say, I know that it's true that I don't have this much influence because when people make this objection to me, I always say, oh, well, have I persuaded you not to vote? They go, no, I'm still going to vote. I haven't changed my behavior. So I don't think there's a whole lot of worry that what will happen as a result of me making these arguments is that people will drop out. I think a stronger interpretation of this argument, and I think this is the way most philosophical defenders of a duty to vote mean it, is that this is kind of a test. So the worry is not that people will actually drop out and nobody will vote, but it's more that the fact that it would be very bad if no one did it implies that it's wrong for you not to do it. But the worry about this is this just general style of objection seems unpersuasive. So this is an argument that originates with Jeff Brennan and Lauren Lomaski. They say you could make that sort of argument about all sorts of actions that are obviously morally permissible. So you say their example, I believe, is a dentist and a farmer. So somebody says, oh, you know what? I don't want to be a farmer. I want to be a dentist. And somebody objects to the dentist and says, well, what if nobody farmed? We would starve to death. And the dentist says, well, yeah, no, that's true. We would all starve to death. It would be bad if nobody farmed and everybody was a dentist. That would probably not be a great world to live in. But that doesn't imply that for me, as a particular individual on the margin, I have a moral obligation to farm. Given that we can see there are sufficiently many farmers, we're not at risk of a food shortage. It seems at a minimum morally permissible for me to do something else, and something else that might actually end up helping more people in light of the fact that my contribution to farming is going to be pretty insignificant.
But what if lots and lots of people started reading why it's okay to ignore politics and were convinced by the arguments, and overnight, I mean, a significant percentage of them would simply start ignoring politics? Could that be a problem?
Yeah, no, like I said, well, it wouldn't be a problem for me. I'd be rich, I think, at that point. So, I would love, in a way, I would love that scenario. I'm not holding out a whole lot of hope for that scenario. But actually, Brennan and Lomaski argue that even that is unlikely because they note that as more and more people stop voting, this raises the power of an individual vote. So you could imagine the case where, so here's the kind of glib response to, what if everybody stopped voting? You say, well, okay, then I'll vote. Because then I'll determine the outcome of the election. Then surely it's rational for me to vote if I'm the only one doing it, because my vote, is going to be decisive. And so what they say is, look, as fewer and fewer people vote, each remaining vote has more and more power. And so there is this kind of self-correcting mechanism here, where if somehow my book persuaded, yeah, I don't know, 30 million to stop voting, then I'd say, well, okay. If you're deliberating about whether or not to vote, the odds of your vote actually being decisive are now not so bad because there are so few voters, in which case maybe you should vote.
So I've asked you about local politics. Do you think that in a slightly less complex world or society like we had, for example, 200 years ago, 100 years ago, when people started getting the right to vote, that it would be wiser for people to engage in politics? I mean, do you think that in a less complex world, maybe it would be possible to acquire enough information to pick the right candidates, the right parties, and so on. Of course, one could argue that 200 years ago or so, people were much less educated. But putting that aside for a minute, what do you think?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. So I want to reserve judgment as a non-historian. So I would say, just as a general principle, and this is maybe, like you said, sort of the local politics issue, where you say, look, knowing that there's a pothole that needs to be fixed, that's not a super complicated question, and it seems like that's a pretty easy one to solve. Yeah, I think when questions get less complex, it's probably easier to know what the right thing to do is. Like I said, like historically, I think this is going to be an issue. To what extent, society today is more or less complex than hundreds of years ago. Although I do think that there's this further issue, which we kind of alluded to, which is just, information alone is not enough to cast a good vote. You also have to be unbiased. And one of my favorite examples of this, and I talk about this in the book, and this goes to the point about complexity too, is they have political partisans watch footage of a protest, and but it's the same video, it's the same protest, but they just tell them that the cause of the protester differs. And so, as you might expect, these like conservative watchers of the video are more likely to say that the police violated the rights of conservative protesters and than liberal protesters, and you reverse it with liberals. But what is like really fascinating about this is they'll ask partisans, were the protesters like blocking the walkway or something like that? Very, very simple question. And if you have a conservative watching the protest, and they say, like, oh, these are conservative protesters, by the way, they're much less likely to say that the conservative protesters blocked the walkway than the liberal protesters, and again, vice versa. And so you say complexity is only one issue here. This is not a complex issue. It's like, did they block the walkway or not? But partisan bias made it actually very difficult for them, I think, to give a sort of impartial judgment about a very simple question.
So, talking about the moral side of things, do you think that political abstention, as some people argue, sends a morally wrong message? I mean, perhaps we could connect this with virtue ethics, for example. I mean, would it be the case that if people abstain, they are sending a morally wrong message to other people?
Yeah, so I think this is an interesting question, that maybe voting or political participation has this kind of symbolic value. In the book, I discuss that I'm kind of skeptical about arguments that talk about the message that your action sends rather than the consequences of your action. So I give the case of an asteroid is headed towards your town or something like that, and you decide, you say, like, look, here's something I could do. I could walk across town where there's a wishing well and throw a penny in the wishing well and publicly wish for the asteroid to, I don't know, be pulverized or something like that. I say, well, this sends the message that it's really important that this asteroid not hit. I don't think most people would say you have an obligation to perform this symbolic action because it's purely symbolic. It's not actually going to have an effect on whether or not the asteroid hits. And so if you stayed home, or better yet, you don't stay home, but you say, look, I am worried that this asteroid is going to hit. So what I'm going to do is take consequential action. So maybe I'm going to help people evacuate, knowing that I can't really affect whether the asteroid's going to hit. I'm going to take consequential action. I don't think there's any danger that you send the wrong message in that case. And similarly, when it comes to politics, like casting a vote is kind of like throwing the penny in the wishing well, where it's like, okay, you're showing that you care about stuff, but you're not actually affecting the things that you care about. And so if you say, look, I'm not going to worry about political participation, but what I am going to do is take direct actions maybe to mitigate some of the harms caused by the political system. So maybe you raise funds for organizations that fight for racial justice or work for food insecurity or whatever the case may be. That's kind of like helping people evacuate from the asteroid. You're not sending the signal that you're trying to ameliorate the root of the problem, but you are taking consequential action to help people. And I think that's perfectly morally adequate.
So I have here two or three more challenges that you also address in the book. There are people that say that that look at political abstention as a sort of privilege. I mean, they say that only people that have a privileged social position can abstain from politics, really. So what would be your response to that?
Yeah, so I think there's a difference between saying it is a privilege to be in a position where you're unlikely to be harmed by politics versus it's a privilege to not participate in politics. I think those are two different claims. So the first claim that, yeah, people in privileged positions or it is a privileged position to not have to worry that politics is going to harm you. I think that's absolutely right. That is a position of privilege. But then there's this further question of, okay, suppose you are in this position where you think, look, like the political system, regardless of who the president is, you're going to turn out fine, which is not going to be the case for everyone. You say, well, okay, then what should I do, given that I am in this privileged position? I say, well, one option would be political activism, but as we've discussed, that actually has a very low likelihood of ameliorating injustice. And so my view is if you do find yourself in a privileged position, what you should do is take effective steps to mitigating injustice. So this might be, again, direct steps to combat food insecurity, fight for racial justice, things like this. It doesn't have to be with your vote. In fact, it's probably more effective if you take more direct steps.
Right. What about when people say that historically there were many people that sacrificed themselves for you to now have the right to vote, and so that sort of morally obliges you to vote. So what do you think about that?
Yeah, so a couple of thoughts. So one is, I think that there are ways that you can express your gratitude that don't involve voting. So an analogy that I give in the book is to a free press. So you can acknowledge that lots of people fought hard for freedom of the press, and moreover, that this is a very important freedom, and that you should be grateful that people have made this sort of sacrifice. But from that, it doesn't follow that the only appropriate form of expressing your gratitude is, starting a blog or something like that. So like exercise, starting your own newspaper or something like that, like exercising your freedom of the press. So no, there are all sorts of ways that, so you just, you could write an op-ed or something like that, or like make a short video and say like, look, this is this really important thing and we should be grateful that people have made this sacrifice. You don't have to do the exact thing that they sacrificed for. And so similarly, we could say, look, many, many people did fight and make sacrifices for the right to vote, and this is important, and we should be grateful. But it doesn't follow from that that the only appropriate way to express that gratitude is to do the thing that they fought for, in the same way that you don't have to, start a printing press or create a printing press or something like that to express your gratitude for freedom of the press.
Can people who don't participate in politics complain about political outcomes? Because that's another thing that sometimes people say, oh, if you don't vote, then whatever the results, you don't have the right to complain about them.
I hope so. I hope we have the right to complain because I complain a lot. And so I hope I have a good argument. I think the answer is yes. And my reason for saying that is the if you don't do this, then you can't complain. That general style of argument is most persuasive when doing that thing has a realistic chance of changing the relevant outcome. So an example might be something like, you say, oh, my lower back is always sore in the morning when I wake up. And a friend says, oh, I know how to fix that. Do this yoga for 10 minutes a day in the morning, and that'll take care of it. Easy. And you say, yeah, but I'm not gonna do it. Not worth the 10 minutes. And then the next day you complain that your back is sore. It seems to me like your friend could say, look, you can't complain because I told you how to fix the problem. That strikes me as all completely reasonable. But voting is not like that, because it's not as though if you voted, there was a very high likelihood that this would change the outcome for the better. It in all likelihood would not have changed the outcome. So it's more like, complaining about the weather. It seems to me like you don't have to try to do anything to try to change the outcome of the weather, to be able to completely say, oh, this weather's terrible. You say, oh, well, why don't you do something about it? He's like, what are you talking about? I can't do anything about the weather. That's just kind of the way it is. You can still complain about it. And politics is sort of the same thing, where for all practical purposes, for a particular individual, it's like the weather. You can't really change it. And that doesn't mean you can't complain about it. You can complain about it simply in virtue of it being bad.
In the book, you also talk about the therapeutic benefits of ignoring politics, both for the person himself or herself, their relationships, and society as a whole. You've already mentioned some of them, but could you tell us about them?
Sure, right. So we talked a little bit about some of the social costs where you're breaking up friendships and all of these things. Yeah, and so one interesting statistic is that people really don't experience much psychological benefit from seeing their side win, quote unquote. So if your favorite presidential candidate wins, maybe you experience a little bit of relief, but it's not this huge gain. But people are actually really devastated. When their candidate loses, it really makes them miserable. So the researchers found out that the negative effect of seeing your candidate lose was roughly as bad as losing your job, which is really one of the worst experiences that someone can have. And this kind of goes back to the point I was making about watching the news, where you do have it within your power to detach from these things that make you miserable. So this is another case I give in the book, where if you have this friend who's constantly telling you how much they hate mushroom pizza, they say, I'm miserable eating mushroom pizza. And I say, okay, but I'm looking at you and you're eating mushroom pizza every day for lunch. Like, what gives? Like, you're not being forced to eat mushroom pizza. Just stop eating mushroom pizza. That would be a perfectly reasonable reaction for that friend to have. Just stop eating it. You'd be a lot happier. And I think that this is true about politics too, where people are like, oh, it's so miserable. I'm looking at Facebook and look at all these horrible things politicians are doing in the news. They're doing all these terrible things. It's like, well, like here, you can turn off the TV, you can change the channel, and you'll probably be a lot happier for it. Your relationships with other people will probably be better for it. You probably won't be as hostile towards people on the other side of the political aisle. So even leaving aside some of the moral stuff, I think you're just going to be happier if you tune out a lot of this stuff and focus on other things.
Okay, great. So, I mean, in the book, it seems that some of the proposals that you put forth for us to deal with politics in a more healthy way, let's say, seem to be, at least to me, a little bit libertarian. So, how do you think about the role that governments should play in society? I mean, particularly taking into account that people perhaps should ignore a little bit more politics.
So a couple of things. So, I mean, I'm happy to have the government provide public goods, a social minimum, those sorts of things. And so, although I am not overly enthusiastic about how well they do those things. So, for example, I don't think that the United States government's track record on things like the environment, and national defense is all that great. The track record is not very good, and I think that's like predictable given the incentives and limitations that government actors have. But even setting that aside, so you might worry, okay, if we do acknowledge that there is a role for the government to provide these sorts of public goods, at least in principle. So we might say, yeah, the government has done a really bad job of providing us with clean air, or yeah, like those sorts of things, or having a good military policy or something like that. And so what we need is we need like really informed voters to hold politicians accountable when they fail. And so if people are ignoring politics, how are we going to get the government to do that? And my response to that is it's similar to the kind of case I gave earlier with the farmer or the person deciding to become a farmer or a dentist. You could say it is important that we have enough voters, but that doesn't mean that you as a particular individual on the margin have a duty to vote. So you might say something like, it's really important that people get fed. And for that to happen, we need to have enough farmers. And you could say, okay, well, I'm looking out in the world and it looks like we do have enough farmers. So then how can I contribute to getting people fed? And you might say the most efficient thing for me to do is to say, I don't know, donate or work at an understaffed food bank. And so there's this division of labor here where you say some people can farm, other people can work at a food bank. And in fact, this is a better situation than having everyone farm. Because more people will, in fact, get fed if you have some farmers, some people working at a food bank, if you have this division of labor. And I think something similar is true of politics, where you could say, look, it is important that we have sufficiently many well-informed and unbiased voters, but that doesn't mean that everybody has to do it. And in fact, it's better if we have enough people doing it, and then the rest of us can do other forms of private altruism, which will actually be more impactful at the margin.
So what would be, what were the kinds of services that you think government should be responsible for? Like the kinds of services that the government should provide people with?
Yeah, so for me, to some extent, it's an empirical question. So I think it would be fair to call me a consequentialist libertarian. And so a lot of what I think the government should be doing, I think, is going to be a matter of what ends up working. So in principle, I'm a big fan of something like a social minimum. And in particular, I would say probably the best system is something along the lines of what Milton Friedman proposed, where essentially, as you become poorer and poorer, you just get more and more money from the state. So just something like a pure cash transfer system, I think would work nicely. I think it would be far more efficient than what we currently have. I'm all on board with the government taking a role in providing environmental goods. So I would be more than happy with something like a carbon tax. Again, the government's provision of environmental goods has not been great. But in principle, I'm happy with them doing that, providing national defense and so on. So there are a lot of things that I'm perfectly happy to have the state doing, although I'm cautious about how well they do these things.
What about issues like economic inequality? Because that's an issue that people worry a lot about nowadays, particularly in the West. Do you think that there would be other better ways for people to deal with that issue aside from the government participating in a sort of redistribution?
Yeah, so I think one thing that some philosophers talk about, although I think political philosophers should talk more about in general, is the role of economic growth in alleviating poverty. So I think something like cash transfers from the state are important, but I think what ultimately makes people wealthier is something like economic growth. So you say, today, I don't know, I'm fascinated by work on the time price of goods, where you say in 1960, you had to, I'm just making up the numbers, but it's like in 1960, you had to work an hour and a half to buy a loaf of bread. In 2020, you have to work, I don't know, 12 minutes, whatever, to buy a loaf of bread. And that's what makes us richer, is that for every hour you work, you can buy more and better stuff. And that comes about as a result of economic growth. And so, and then there's a lot of debate about what sorts of policies, in fact, accelerate economic growth. But I think that that's actually a really overlooked component of this issue of poverty reduction and economic inequality.
Right. And what about taxes? I mean, do you think that taxes are too high in the US, for example, and for whom? I mean, those kinds of things.
I don't know. So I would reserve judgment of making a claim about how, if taxes should be higher or lower. I mean, I do think there. So sometimes people think, well, if you want lower taxes, you're accepting some kind of like trickle down theory where somehow the wealth will trickle down from the rich to the poor. I don't think that's exactly the reason you might be wary of taxes from a consequentialist point of view. I think one worry is just like what one issue is, how well are taxes actually, is tax revenue being spent? So for example, we talked about the efficiency of social welfare programs. Again, I'm not getting this exactly right, but the numbers are something like for every family of three below the poverty line in the United States, if we just took all of the US's redistributive spending and just transferred cash directly to families in poverty, you could provide each of them with something like $60,000 a year, some extremely high amount, which suggests that our redistributive system is not particularly efficient. And so that's just one worry that I have about taxes, is I'm not convinced that they're spent particularly well. But I also think, that there's something to be said for, worries about the incentives that taxes create. So you want people working, you want people investing, you want people having excess income that they can donate to charity. So like billionaire philanthropy, I think actually is pretty good on the whole. And so I wouldn't want to make a definitive statement about whether taxes are too high. But I think there is good reason to be skeptical that taxes are going to be this really effective instrument of social justice.
Okay, so as a last topic, let's talk about effective altruism. I've already had on the show one of the major figures in the movement of effective altruism, Peter Singer. So, I mean, what is it about, how would you define effective altruism, and what are the sorts of issues that politics usually deals with that you think effective altruism would address better?
So the way I understand effective altruism is basically this idea that we should put our philanthropic resources to the use that does the most good. And we should be really rigorous when we think about this as well. So we shouldn't just be sitting in the armchair and think, oh, okay, what would be the best use of my money? We need to be more rigorous than that. But I think what is maybe controversial about effective altruism is this idea that we should always deploy our philanthropic resources to the uses that do the most good, because this means, I don't know, not donating money to, an art museum to build a new wing. That's probably not what you should be doing. You should be donating it to the Against Malaria Foundation, because that's just going to do more good for the world. But I actually think that this idea is right. I'm a pretty strong proponent of effective altruism, and so I think, yeah, when we are deciding where to give our charitable dollars, how to spend our time, we really should be channeling that to the most effective uses. And so, for example, there are a bunch of organizations now that will help you determine what those sorts of causes are. So in the book, I talk about the Against Malaria Foundation, because in terms of bang for charitable buck, that's one of the best ones out there. And so my view, in terms of individual moral obligations, is that given that the expected social benefit of your political activism is very, very low, if you want to do good for the world, just kind of forego politics and spend the time that you would have spent on political activism on effective altruism. And so for most readers, that's probably going to involve earning extra income or otherwise raising funds for these effective charities. In terms of politics and effective altruism, like policy-wise, I mean, I think right now the policy change that would do the most good for the world, that would be the most effective form of altruism, would be easing immigration restrictions. So I'm a big advocate of open borders. If somebody said, okay, you know, you basically have a magic wand to make the world a better place, and you can only do one thing to alleviate suffering in the world, allowing people to move to the countries of their choice, I think would be the thing I would use my magic wand on.
Do you think that we should apply effective altruism at an international level, or do you think that perhaps applying it at the local level would be better? I'm asking you that because I would imagine that it's easier for people to help other people that are part of their social circle and that they know than to help, let's say, a complete stranger in Africa or whatever. Because, I mean, you mentioned the Against Malaria Foundation, and that's sort of an international thing that all people from all places can participate in if they want. But, I mean, there's still that thing about our sort of human nature where we tend to prefer helping people that are closer to us.
So I think that's right in terms of, like you said, human nature. We do just tend to prefer to you know help the people that you can see,
yeah,
or help your family. And so and there is maybe some sort of slight informational advantage there too. Or is it like I know, you know, in terms of like buying my daughter a gift, like I know my daughter very well, and so I know what she would like as a gift. But I also think, you know, we just do have a lot of evidence now that these international programs like the Against Malaria Foundation do in fact do a lot of good. And so even if you know, you never meet the recipients of the donation, I don't think we have to be too skeptical that they do good. And then this goes to the issue is, so I buy, I don't know, the gift for my daughter or something like that. And that makes her marginally happier. But I do think that the good I would do by sending that money overseas via the Against Malaria Foundation or something like that will just in fact do a lot more good. And I mean, this gets into Peter Singer stuff about demanding this. So does this mean you can never buy gifts for your family? I don't know. This is one of those arguments that it's tough to refute. I mean, I think Singer makes some really powerful arguments. But what I do want to say, just in terms of the context of my arguments about political participation, is let's leave aside the question of the quantity of help you have to give. So in other words, so maybe you think you have to spend 90% of your time working for effective altruistic ends or something like that. Or maybe you think it's only 10% of your time. I'd say, okay, take whatever time, whatever percentage of your time you think you have to spend on helping other people, and just dedicate that to, again, I don't know, raising funds for the effect for the Against Malaria Foundation rather than political altruism. So I say, I'm not going to take a stand on how much time you have to spend. What I want to take a stand on is the quality of the help you give. So however much time you spend making the world a better place, spend that on effective altruism rather than politics.
Okay, so one last question, and since we mentioned Peter Singer, do you extend your ethics to other animals, for example, to all sentient beings, or is it exclusive to humans?
No, I think it's all sentient beings. I think, and it's, you know, it's interesting. Singer's arguments have persuaded me. He's influenced me quite a bit on many things, and his arguments about our duties to animals I find pretty persuasive, and so I think not only do we have duties to benefit humans and to prevent the suffering of other humans, I think we have similar sorts of duties to not harm animals and to prevent the suffering of animals and so on. So I think it's whatever beings have welfare are beings that we have duties to.
Okay, great. So just before we go, where can people find your work on the internet?
So you can, I have a personal web page, although that needs to be updated, but it's a couple of years out of date. It's cfryman.com, so C and then my last name. Although I do blog at 200 Proof Liberals, and so I'm more active there than on my current web page, although hopefully at some point I get my current web page updated, and so that'll contain more of my work than it currently does.
Yeah, any social media or not?
So no regular social media, although I have done a number of appearances on social media. So I think if you're interested in if you've listened to me talk for an hour and you want more, you could search for various social media appearances. I think wherever you would hear podcasts. So I think I use Spotify. I think I'm on a number of episodes of different programs on Spotify and on YouTube. And there aren't that many Chris Frymans out there. So you punch my name into those things and you'll probably find what you're looking for.
Okay, great. And you can also buy the book again, Why It's Okay to Ignore Politics. And Dr. Fryman, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, likewise.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for watching this interview until the end. As you might have noticed, I've started this channel back in February 2018 and have been putting out regular interviews with top academics and scholars from a variety of fields. So, to keep the channel sustainable, I would like to ask you to please pay a visit to my Patreon page and to consider making a pledge there. If you prefer PayPal, I also have links to that in the description box of the video. Otherwise, and if you like what I'm doing, please leave a like, share it, and hit the subscription button. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and PayPal supporters, Karen Litske and Blanchett Perga-Larsen, Lau Guerrero, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunde, Ricardo Valadimiro, Craig Healy, Adam Kessel, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, Anian Kata, Jacob Klinkby, Matthew Whittingbird, Arno Wolf, Tim Hollesy, Henry Kalenius, John Connors, Paulina Baron, Philip Force Connolly, Jerry Mueller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Voss, Bo Weingard, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, Dan Demetriou, Robert Windegger, Rui Inácio, Arthur Coe, Zoop, Marco Neves, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Thomas Trumbull, Bernardo Seixas, Pablo Santurbano, Simon Columbus, Jorge Espinha, Phil Kavanagh, Corey Clark, Mark Blythe, Roberto Inguanzo, Mikkel Stormir, Eric Neumann, Samuel Andreev, Tiago Nunes, Bernard Hugni, Alexander Dunbauer, Omri Hixon, Fergal Cusson, Yevhen Bodrenko, Hal Herzog, Nuno Machado, Don Ross, João Alves da Silva, Jonathan Liebrandt, Özlem Bulut, Nathan Nguyen, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, JW, João Eira, Tom Hummel, David Sloan Wilson, Yacila Deza Araújo, Eden Solon, Romain Roach, Dmitry Grigoriev, Diego Londoño Correa, Tom Roth, and Yannick Punter. My producers, Cesar Webb, Jim Frank, Lucas Stefaniak, Ian Gilligan, Sergio Godriano, Luis Caetano, Matthew Lavender, Tom Vanegdam, Curtis Dixon, João Linhares, Benedict Mueller, Vega Giddy, Sardes France, and Niruban Balachandran. And my executive producers, Michel Rujewski, Rosie, and James Pratt. Thank you for all.